Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence, here to provide you with the latest news and trends in the commercial real estate market. I'm excited to have a special guest on with me today, Andy Betcher, Head of Research at TREP, to run through a bit of a capital markets outlook for 2026. Andy's a seasoned commercial real estate markets expert who focuses in CRE credit and bank lending data. At TREP, Andy's research helps lenders, investors, and market participants interpret key credit and pricing signals shaping the industry. Before TREP, Andy worked in wholesale credit analytics at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, where he analyzed credit market conditions. Andy, thank you so much for joining me on CRE Exchange.
Thanks. It's a little surreal to be here, I must admit.
Absolutely. Well, so for our listeners, the connection here is I've attended a few of your banking and CRE lending webinars, and you've been a listener of CRE Exchange for a while. We finally met at a CRE Influencer Summit in Palm Springs just back in September. So this is a bit of a full circle moment for me as well.
It was cool. I feel bad for Zach, who sat between the two of us as we were connected on many different points.
Absolutely. We also share another connection, and this will be a good jumping off point for our conversation. But we both went to George Washington University. So you want to share a little bit about what you studied there?
Yeah, I have an undergrad in mathematics and computer science from Augustana College in Illinois, and then got my graduate degree from George Washington University, our shared alma mater there. And I actually am in a doctorate in engineering program now, which I think there was something that you were in CEES also, right?
I was. It was civil engineering, but we'll put a call out for our listeners. For if you're looking for an AI and CRE topic for your dissertation, where I hear you're open for potential topics.
That is correct. I'm open to all ideas at the moment for integrating commercial real estate and AI into a praxis or a defendable dissertation, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I'm excited to read it by the time you get to it. So let's start from the beginning. Walk us through your career. You start at the Federal Reserve Board. You want to tell us what you're working on then?
Yeah, this is a little bit like, how is Andy on the podcast? How did he become a head of research at TREP when, I don't have a whole lot of public publications? And so I started at the Board of Governors as a research assistant way back in 2003 under the Greenspan chairmanship, and joined a group called Microstatistics. And it's not small statistics, it was about banking statistics. So the micro was really like about cross-sectional statistics. And it provided an interesting foundation for what ended up being a fulsome career. So only in hindsight, you make sense of things. And my primary responsibility at the time was drawing replacements for when banks merged, closed, and declined participation in voluntary survey panels. And some of those data ends up in big aggregate Fed releases that actually you cite on the show relatively frequently. So an example of that is the Federal Reserve's H8 data, which is a weekly estimate of balance sheet loans that banks would make. I was in the thick of it in terms of when a bank merged, how do you handle the statistical integrity from week to week to so that the aggregates made sense? So cut my teeth in statistics and data modeling there when I first joined.
So then you moved on to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. What were you working on there?
Yeah, it's an interesting transition. So when I was at the board, I volunteered for an assignment with respect to credit unions. And it was not exactly the kind of most glamorous assignment because the Fed wasn't responsible for credit union supervision. But when the financial crisis hit, the impacts were widespread. And so one of the potential impacts was to the credit union system, which had a fair share of, at the time, structural connections to the jumbo MBS market. And so since I had volunteered for like an analytical assignment relatively early when I joined, I was a handful of people that actually knew anything about how the credit union system worked and how the kind of credit transmission in terms of credit stress could flow through that system. So I got a baptism in stress testing, where I was actually stress testing the entire credit union system. So that was roughly $800 billion in store of assets. And that's the kind of transition to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Post-GFC, the supervisory system consolidated around a couple centers, and the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago stood up a wholesale credit risk center. So it was a center of expertise around analyzing bank balance sheet lending to commercial real estate, to C&I loans, that's the business loans, and at the time was small non-bank finance, but that particular segment has grown quite a bit. So kind of parlayed the stress testing experience from credit unions into the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and was part of the effort to build out the stress testing models when DFAST and CCAR first got going.
Help me connect the dots there. You're deep in credit analytics. You get into stress testing. Walk me through how that turns into a career in CRE credit specifically.
Yeah, I kind of just fell into it, honestly. Kind of the threads through the whole career was really the intersection of data, technology, and finance. So my graduate degree is in finance. It's not in data analytics, it's in finance. So understanding the loan structures and understanding the business dynamics on the financing market. And so that threaded together, and we were a little short-staffed on the commercial real estate side in terms of analyzing full-blown portfolios. So not analyzing what I'll call extreme tail risk. Stress testing is not an expectation, it's the unexpected. And so I was moving closer to like, what's the kind of expected portfolio analytics piece? And so just fell into commercial real estate really just because we're like, hey, we need another person that knows this space. And I really just fell in love with it, of the multiple cycles. You have property cycles, you have credit cycles, you're trying to make sense of that together, then translating that, at least at the time at the Fed, in terms of, was there risk building in the banking system that needed some sort of examination or supervisory guidance? And that's when COVID hit, which was a wild time in terms of commercial real estate.
I think you've already kind of bridged this for us, but you have this 22-year career dealing with a lot of the same data. And how does that experience relate to why you're at TREP now?
So there's a regulatory component. When I was at the Fed, I was also part of the team that stood up the data efforts around vended data. So not only was I part of the regulatory process, I was also part of the team that was ingesting data to support those stress testing efforts. And TREP, I worked with TREP for a long time, meaning I was working with TREP data as part of the CMBS side of TREP's business, as well as the Fed regulatory side. So I had a lot of connections in terms of just understanding the CMBS market in addition to the banking market. And that's what led me here, is that I had an opportunity to kind of transition from knowing a lot about the regulatory side of the world, and then had a chance to lead a research team through the kind of AI transition and being part of that, of how do you think about credit research in a world where there's so much more power available to you than beyond just the rows and columns that are in those two, you know, what I'll call three collections, the CMBS side, and then the two taller collections that I'm a part of.
Andy, I think most of our listeners are probably familiar with TREP and may only associate it with CMBS. Do you want to give us a little bit of an overview? You know, we've had your colleague Steven on the show before, but remind us again what TREP actually does across banks, private credit, and broader capital markets.
Yeah, for sure. And Steven's great. He's on my team. So when I told him that he wasn't going to be a three-peat guest, he was a little sad. So TREP actually has several verticals beyond the CMBS market. We're known for the CMBS data. We got our start there when that market was first developed. TREP had been written into the service for contracts to collect and manage all that data. So, you know, we have financials and loan histories going back 30 plus years, which is amazing. Beyond that, I think of it as it's a broader wholesale credit data vendor, as well as technology and product solutions. So there is a CLO vertical, the collateralized loan obligations that corporates issue. So there's a cash flow engine for that. And then we run a couple consortiums around bank loans, as well as, you know, information about loan spreads that we collect on a weekly basis to get an idea of kind of what balance sheet lenders are pricing loans at. And then there's a default model and different products. So I think of it as an intersection, just from that kind of same career overlap, is an intersection of data, technology, and analytics, trying to help clients and customers make sense of what is a relatively large market.
So when we had our call before this, I like that you described yourself as more of a macro taker than, say, a forecaster. And a couple of things we talked about, you have GDP now signals, you have the New York Fed's GDP now, they might say something different, the Atlanta, New York one. You have labor data saying one thing, consumer credit data saying another. So you're getting a lot of different signals about how strong the economy actually is. So you have a lot of this macro uncertainty. And I think you mentioned the kind of dispersion in the real economy. How does that kind of take shape in the CRE credit market and lending behavior? I know that's a big ask, but I want you to kind of set the stage for us.
Yeah, I'll do my best to try to walk through it. And it's unique for me for the first time. I have access to a chief economist on staff. I was also a Fed ambassador when I worked at the Fed, meaning people would come to the Reserve Bank and ask questions. And I was one of the people that could answer the questions. And I had no insight at all into any macro forecasts. When we met, we described it as I was a macro taker because I was as reliant on the GDP now and other things like that, even though I worked at the organization that produced those. And so how I try to make sense of the kind of various signals is every data release or data analysis that I do or the team does has some different sources of variability. Just the nature of data measurement. And so there's going to be variance across different ways that you can measure the economy. And it's big. The U.S. economy is extremely large. It's very diverse. There's a lot of different pressures on it. And there's a lot of different opportunities within it. And so, you know, what I'm looking at is what are the different ways that particular tool is measuring those outcomes. So the GDP now from Atlanta really shot up within the past couple of weeks. When I listened to the show last week, you cited it, and it was from net exports. And so my like spidey sense is, are we really exporting that much, or is that kind of a measurement thing? And then I look at the other indicators to say, is that a confirming signal? Is there something different? And then ultimately, the macro economy is just one component, and it's on the CRE side. And so if the dynamics that are occurring on the macro side, at least it looks like going into 2026, is that it seems to be slightly disconnected from the CRE expectations. And so I'm trying to translate what we've had relatively decent economic growth over the past several years, but the CRE fundamentals in different property types have been more, at least from a delinquency rate perspective, were much more elevated than you'd think given the macro conditions. And then we're kind of like swapping that. I'm trying to use the macro signals to get an idea of maybe where the 10-year will go. It's anybody's guess, but I'm like, okay, it's probably like a 4, 4.5-ish kind of market. And what does that mean for credit growth? What does that mean for refinanceability? What does that mean for commercial prices? And then that's where I started, is I'm trying to use those macro signals to get me an idea of where I think the financing market might be headed.
We'll put you on blast a little later in the conversation to give us some actual predictions or some numbers there. But one of the things we wanted to talk about, and I just got back from the CRE Finance Council's conference in Miami. TREP obviously has a big presence as a CMBS data provider, but I think in the last few years, conference has made it an effort to include more balance sheet lenders, and not just stick on the securitized space, so more broader CRE debt. And I heard a few things, so I'm going to have you kind of react to those as I go through them. So a few themes that stood out to me, and we already just mentioned this, but everybody has got this macro uncertainty. Kind of under the surface, you have this sort of K-shaped economic recovery post-COVID, the higher income portions of the U.S. doing a lot better than the lower. I heard a lot about selective liquidity. There's a lot of debt out there, but it's chasing the same deals, at least in CMBS. And refinancing's dominating activity. Not a lot of acquisition activity relative to pre-COVID or similar levels in terms of dollars. And then broadly, the idea that the securitized markets they're adapting, but even though delinquencies are up, they're not deteriorating. So you focus on banks, not securitization. So kind of pressure test that for me. But does that line up with what's going on in the bank credit space?
Yeah. And we can talk a little bit about the CMBS side too. So there's two parts to that. In terms of, I'll call it the schedule of maturities on the CMBS side is a little more structural, meaning that today's 25 or tomorrow's 26 or originations or refinances are 2015's originations or 2016's right. originations. So you have to look back to what was happening 10 years ago. And so it looks like going into 26 on the CMBS side, at least the debt yields that are coming in are better than they were last year, meaning the loans that are scheduled to refi are going to be probably 100 basis points higher on the debt yield side than last year. You still have a kind of a structural SASB preference to the conduit. So that's to your point about chasing the same kind of high quality cash flowing assets. That's going to certainly continue.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting, too, is you consistently heard that we're not going to get to the levels of conduit that we saw in 2019 unless the 10-year comes down substantially. And between you and me, I'm not sure we're going to get there for some time.
Yeah. You still have a buckle in the yield curve. That five-year debt is probably still going to be attractive because the yield curve kind of has a lower shape right in that middle there. And so the five-year interest-only structural preference will continue to occur as I'll call it the refis from the 2015, 2016 vintages that might have had a lower starting base rate because, we were still in the ZIRP era at the time. It kind of leg into the refinance. Just basically, it's a five-year option to grow the incomes at the property by refinancing into a kind of a five-year IO structure.
Yeah, but go ahead. Give us some bank stats if you'd like.
So one of the interesting things about working at banks is that the visibility into them is a little bit different than the CMBS market. So the CMBS market has a lot more kind of like largely available information in terms of the rents and expenses from the tenant side, and then also how the loan's performing in terms of both availability and frequency. So on the bank side, there's a couple different aspects that I look at on the bank side that maybe not everybody is aware of unless you come to the webinar like you did. And so one is that the bank source of capital is deposits. They're functionally callable at any point in time. And so the bank's going to actively be managing its asset liabilities or the mismatch going in on the loan originations, which means the kind of loan structures that are typical on a bank balance sheet are different. So one example of that is that the median tenor within the consortia is 3 years. So that means that bank balance sheets are going to be rolling over much more frequently than the CMBS market. The implication for that is that 2026, you're talking about 2022 and 2023 rollovers. And as you start moving closer to the 2023 horizon, you are getting more into the higher interest rate dynamic than the lower interest rate dynamic that was occurring in 21 and 22. So that's kind of one way I'm looking at it, is like what's scheduled to mature in 26 is probably as a whole a better underwritten vintage than the 21, 22s. So that's one aspect of banks that I look at. Another aspect is the loan structure, the interest rate structures. At least in the consortia, about 2/3 of the consortia is on a floating rate basis, which means a lot of that interest rate movement from 23 already kind of worked its way through, or it's on the tail end of it. It's not at the beginning. And so this maturing vintage that's coming through, those borrowers have already started figuring out how to handle the much higher rates than they had at the beginning. At least from like a loan structure perspective, shorter term floating rate debt, it's just a different animal than the CMBS side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you kind of already mentioned this, but one thing I remember in our conversation is that you said that the bank market is effectively structurally an extension market. But when you're talking to CMBS folks, all you hear is doom and gloom about the extend and pretend. Is five-year paper really seven-year paper? What are we actually selling to bond investors?
Yeah, on the bank side, extensions were a feature of the market. They still are. And so the kind of rate of extensions that were occurring in 2019, that pace is largely similar. Is it statistically significantly the same? I haven't done that test, but it's similar relative to what it was pre-pandemic. And that's just a feature of the bank market, is that you have a maturing loan. The bank has a relationship with that borrower typically. And so the kind of options for that borrower go down more into the community banks, And so the bank wants to maintain that relationship and they renew the loan. And so whether you call that an extension or whether you call that a refinance, it's the same borrower and the same property, and it's largely going to be the same credit structure going forward. So it's kind of a structurally extension market. And are there going to be some that, you know, maybe it was more of a pretend deal? Yes, for sure. Like, it's not solely like extension and great. There's going to be some that are like, we're extending this one. It's okay on the LTV. We've seen property prices stabilize recently, but in terms of where you were relative to 2021 or 2022, they're probably down, depending upon how you measure it, 10%, 20%. And so your equity cushion might be a little bit less than you were anticipating at refi time.
So, Andy, you know, one thing we always hear in CMBS worlds is that, or people questioning whether or not the maturity wall is actually going to hit. Is there a maturity wall there on the bank side? Do you realistically expect most of these to extend and continue to roll off?
Yeah, there are extensions on the CMBS side too. So when we did this analysis, and this is going to be upcoming, I think it's going to be done on the same day in terms of the release. Like, what's a hard maturity, meaning that there isn't an extension option as part of the loan package, and what proportion of the CMBS maturities are actually hard in 26. And so when you look at that number that are in 26 that have no more extension options, that's 80 billion roughly across the CMBS space. That's, to me, that it's not a scary number. It's probably refinanceable. When you split that across debt yields, there's roughly 80 billion or so of CMBS loans that have a hard maturity in 2026, meaning that there's not an extension option that's built into the loan docs. Of that 80 billion, there's 28 of it. So what's that percentage? I'll put, you're the civil engineer, you can do that percentage in your head, that has a debt yield less than 8%. So those are where there's going to be a little bit more trouble in terms of trying to figure out how to get those refinanced. And they're likely going to be the potential sources of delinquency going into 2026. So there's a couple of things that I'm looking at that give me some confidence about the bank lending market in 26. That one, in terms of the schedule of maturities, we already talked about that. There's going to be a structural, it's just kind of structural. So I don't think of it in dollars. I think of it as in percents, because the size of the bank loan market is so large that it's, depending on how you measure it, it's like $3 trillion. From the most recent Z1 report, which is the Fed's aggregate flow of funds, and combined with the taller data that we have, from a percentage basis, that is looking like 20% of the book is going to be maturing in 2026. On the whole, that sounds consistent with the loan structures. Then I think what would support getting through 20% of those loans that are scheduled to mature, there's a couple pieces. So one, we already talked about that floating rate exposure. So a chunk of those have already reset. And so the kind of shorter term rate expectations are not going up, they're flat to down. So they're likely going to get a little bit of relief. So that's one part of it on the borrower side. And on the bank side, the bank's risk rate, all of these exposures, goes through their internal rating system and gets a grade effectively assigned to it. And that grade informs how much reserving that the bank's going to hold when they underwrite the loan. Those internal ratings really escalated in 2022 when the rate cycle hit. And prior to that, they went through the ringer in terms of COVID. So, you know, banks were adjusting to lack of hotel demand to then suddenly a boom in hotel demand. And so those dynamics have worked through. So the line of sight on the bank's internal rating system and then the reserving piece is moderating, meaning that they've already held back the reserves to work through the anticipated credit issues. So they have a cleaner balance sheet coming through 2025. So they're in a position to be able to make new credit origination, as well as being able to address refinancings going into 2026. I have a couple other examples if you want to get into it, but that's kind of like giving.
Let's hear some of the examples.
Yeah. So one of the insights that we can get on a taller side is getting this internal rating distribution. We map it to a common scale. And so one being the best, nine being the worst. And so nines functionally are an in default kind of status. And you can see the small proportion that's actually in that 9 category, but you also observe the bank's reserve rate for those loans. And so the reserving rate for the kind of a defaulted loan, on average, 10 to 15%, depending upon the property type. That implies that the value of those properties is, if most bank loans are in this kind of 65 LTV range, implies that the property has dropped between 45 to 50% in value. To me, that's appropriate. And so if you walked in and said, oh, a bank has reserved for their credit loss, assuming the property is going to drop about 50% in value, you'd say, okay, cool. Like the banks have prepared, at least in aggregate, for potential stress. They've reserved for that, which means they're in a better position to make new credit going into 26. And I'd venture most of these maturities are going to be able to roll without an issue.
All right. So, Andy, to get us into our 2026 forecast, we'll focus on directional predictions here, but a little bit of a lightning round. Base case forecast for 2026. Do we think origination volume is going to be up, down, or flat?
Up. We're in the strong up category.
Great. All right. Refi versus acquisition. You think refinancing is still going to be the dominant driver?
That I think so, yes.
What about extensions? You think rates rise, stabilize, or fall?
I think they're going to be stable. I don't think they're going to be changing much from the priors.
And then credit deterioration. Do you think delinquencies and losses meaningfully worsen or stay mostly the same?
I think it's going to be a sorting year for 26 on delinquencies. So I think the overall rate is likely going to be about the same, but the kind of mixture of assets going in and out is going to evolve. They'll be treading under the water, but the surface will stay about the same.
Okay. So, Andy, if you have to summarize your outlook for 2026, what would your kind of one sentence summary be there?
I wish I knew the word past cautious optimism. It's like pretty robust optimism. And I get there a couple of different ways. You were at the Crefcy piece. I think the bullish was the main tone there. And I'll use the H8 and the sluice to help me on the aggregate side. That the pace of credit growth on the H8 recently, which is the weekly estimate, suggested like a 3% credit growth from bank lending on commercial real estate. And the sluice is showing kind of equilibrium on the net demand for new CRE credit and supply being about the same. So I think we're getting to a nice equilibrium on the bank side. And so 3% credit growth and call it 130 plus on the CMBS side, I think that's going to be a pretty good year.
All right. Sounds great. And so, Andy, I think that kind of brings us to the end of our conversation. We like to ask all of our guests the same question, and that's if you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
I wish the LinkedIn algorithms valued or weighted middle of the road, messy middle commentary more heavily than the extreme words of things exploding or things fear maturity wall kind of language. And so I think 26 is going to be the messy middle of as we sort out what's a good asset versus a one that needs some restructuring. And I wish the algos could pick up on that and reward explaining why things are happening versus the headline risk.
Excellent. Well, I think a great way to cap off our discussion, lead us into 2026. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. I think that's all the time we have. And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.